Well, first of all, I didn't use the Oxford text. I have too many philosophy books. I like to limit my purchases. But I'll just read whichever quotes I thought were important. I'll read them right after. Should be pretty much the same as your translation. So I focused on parts one and two. And the bigger picture for me, and all the things he says in books one and two, which is a lot, he goes over all types of things, you know, all the changes in his adolescent life from his escapades and all sorts of things. So there are a lot of things, like in the discussion later on, you guys can bring up certain examples, but I was going to go over more of the bigger picture as it relates to the question that we're asking in the class, which is about the modern self. And Rousseau is personally pretty important to me. He was really my door into philosophy. I was, a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago, as an undergrad, I was said I'm going to law school. After I read Rousseau, I switched into philosophy as a pursuit. But Rousseau really is, I read him in a class on modern political thought, so it's really appropriate that his frame of thinking is applicable to the modern self as well. And really, like all sorts of philosophy, this theme, you know, after reading Rousseau, when you read other philosophies, more contemporary, you see a resemblance in the style of thinking, you know, like we alluded to the dot and the disconnecting ourselves or looking or observing ourselves from above or from somewhere else. And that's a theme that's very prevalent all throughout philosophical history, but I think Rousseau is the first one who really emphasizes it in a different way than Descartes did, or even Locke. And I think the first thing that he does is he has his main work, which is called The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, which is his big political, philosophical work, but actually it's really about everything. But in there, you can really see, I'll just go over very briefly. Basically, what he does is something that was very common during the Enlightenment for many other philosophers, also Hobbes and Locke, when they talk about the social contract. What a lot of these philosophers are doing are deconstructing our society. So kind of like Descartes says, we need to not give into the biases of the knowledge that we have. But what Rousseau does is really turns that, not only Rousseau, but also Hobbes and Locke, to some extent, in his other works. He and they take a more structured, technical approach to this Cartesian meditation idea of disconnecting yourself, you know, the dot. So what he does in the on the Discourse on Inequality is he deconstructs our society, going all the way back to, he does it in a unique way where he describes life of a caveman and kind of builds it up and says, he puts himself in the perspective of a caveman who doesn't have any language and only has the tools and the things that are in nature at his disposal, and how that person and all the others like him would create, you know, society, language, and all the other things which we take for granted today. But in that method, he separates and really makes this method of disengaging ourselves very structured in the way that he reduces things rather than just saying, you know, I'm just going to, like Descartes talks about how all the things that I've learned, all of his education, all the influences culture and society has on him, he's just going to avoid those and have like his own personal meditation. But the problem with this was that we just kind of took his word for it. And obviously, from all the talk of God and religion in Descartes, it's obvious that he doesn't have, you know, complete disengagement. So what Rousseau does in his political work is important to the Confessions. And it's obvious if you guys ever do later on get to read Rousseau's other works, it makes you appreciate the Confessions. But in terms of my contention, really it starts with the first sentence of the work. And in Minds it says, let me go back, he says, I have begun on a work which is without precedent, whose accomplishment will have no imitator. I propose to set before my fellow mortals a man in all the truth of nature, and this man shall be myself. So obviously he's saying that he's full of himself is kind of an understatement. But that's really what I think is his point here is that the self, he really doesn't define it like maybe, you know, a specific definition, but what he's saying is that in his confessions, and the point being something we do in all our lives, is kind of a journey of discovering himself, and in a way that it's always been there, he just has to uncover it. And he goes through his history, he goes through points in his life which he thinks defines him, or were points where something was uncovered, or something in his personality that was repressed before became unrepressed, and he was able to express himself. And obviously he's a very sensitive person. And at first, it's, you know, you might just think because he's French, and he talks a lot about his sex escapades and all the weird stuff that he does, which there's actually, this is surprisingly, in the first two books, it's not as weird as it gets, which is the weird part about Rousseau. He's just strange. But I think when he says, you know, I will have no imitator, and he's asserting that he has found the perfect self, and his discovery to getting there by giving us his history and all the changes in his life is really, he's telling us that in nature, the self is within every single individual, and it's only a matter of discovering that self. And that's why he's doing something different than what Augustine does, for example. So let's move on to my first quotation. So on page... I'll just read it. Hold on a second. So this one's just something that describes how he thought his predisposition, he calls it, which is really what I think is just another way of saying that it's that self that's there but has to be discovered. And he talks about his... He says... regarding his sensibility. So he says, the sentiments I had hitherto formed on the subject, he's referring to his parents here, on the subject were extremely elevated, but altogether imaginary. The habit of living in this peaceful manner soon united me tenderly to my cousin. What was I gonna say? So he's kind of referring to part of his self that really likes to be solitary. I think this is important because it's a part of his process that he alludes to a lot in the whole work, where he says that he had an aversion. He had this calling towards being solitary, doing things by himself. He was independent in that sense. And it was really through his solitary experiences, which I equate with what we were talking about as, you know, the disengaged self, looking at yourself from above or from an observing point of view. It's that frame of mind or those experiences that lead you towards what we could say point B, and then we can figure out a way to get there using, you know, instruments, using or making decisions which can ultimately lead us to our true selves, which according to Rousseau, at least in his whole life, was repressed. Although he says that it was at an early age of 16 that he started to understand how he was different and how his sensuality, if you will, was the good life, the life that was independent of societal constructs, of the biases of what education subjects children to. And because he wrote this during, or he wrote most of his works during the Enlightenment, and it's kind of funny because he was kind of spearhead of the Enlightenment, but ironically he was really against like the main theme of Enlightenment, which is reason. And we talked about this with Locke, obviously, likes reason, so did basically everyone else in the Enlightenment. But just to quickly go back to the discourse on inequality, his main beef is that reason is not the spark that gave us our language, our identity, the construction or the tool of society, civilization. But what he says is it's reason that actually led to the vices, the bad things, which he connotates with civilization and society. So really for Rousseau, what's important is that the natural self, which can be directly equated with what he talks about, the caveman or the savage man, that is the natural self. That's what's being repressed with influences of culture, society, and education. So his journey was, I guess you could say, like precocious, really, because, you know, for him, he loathes about how his potential was repressed. It had a lot to do with his disposition as being a shy person. He had all these fantasies and desires, but he couldn't do anything because he was just by nature shy or pressed and unable to do so. So, but in that, he's telling us that his sensibility, his fondness for the simpler things in life, his ability to take everything in, is the natural self, which human beings have cover up in with all the other things that they're subjected to. And this is a common argument in philosophy in general. It's really goes over all sorts of fields, and it's just the basic idea that you have to reduce and subtract many of the things that you have around you in your present state of mind to dig down into the deeper and kind of the core of your humanness. And Rousseau, this is really Rousseau's entire struggle, his whole life. And, you know, he talks a lot about having, or he has a lot of conflict when he talks about his moral compass and how he was ashamed of a lot of his weird sexual experiences. But really, another thing that I noticed, or I observed, was that another way to explain this process of uncovering is really, he's kind of a very introverted figure. So in psychology, it's a common concept and highly controversial one about people that are introverted or extroverted. So I think Rousseau and a lot of lines of philosophy talk about this process of introversion, not something that is natural, but, you know, you're disposed to, but that everyone has both extroversion and introversion. And it's the introverted self, the introverted state of mind, I shouldn't say self, since that's what we're trying to find out. But the introverted state of mind is what leads us to our self. And that disposition, which kind of gives us differences and different journeys and ways in which we can get to that self. So here he says, the first instance of violence and oppression is so deeply engraved into my soul. This is what he refers to. I think it's something to do with his cousin. I'm not sure which one he's talking about. But he says that every relative idea renews my emotion. The sentiment of indignation, which in its origin had reference only to myself, has acquired such strength and is at present so completely detached from personal motives that my heart is as much inflamed with sight or any relation of act of injustice, whatever may be the object, or wheresoever it may be perpetrated, as if I was the immediate sufferer. So again, his personality, I think, is almost an exception. It's almost a bad example to use this, to use Rousseau as the example of, or the case of finding through the inside our true self. Because he's just as you said earlier, he's just a fascinating mind. He really is different. So that's what makes it confusing in terms of his process. Because if you take it in terms of his process and his crazy life, it's almost like, you know, you're talking or reading about a crazy person. I think the underlying theme really is that he believes that he's by uncovering his natural self, which he believes is like a universal archetype of what it means to be human, he's shown the way. He's a forefather of this sort of, maybe the only sense is a Cartesian meditation of one's own history. And obviously, if we were to do such a thing where you write a biography of yourself and look back from, let's say we've gotten to point B, and we want to figure out how we got there, and why is it that we were so different in all these other stages of our life, you know, it probably wouldn't be as interesting as Rousseau, but you'd probably have just as much to talk about, because it's really the point where you get there, up to that, is what defines you. And I think he kind of has a lamentation in that sense, where he laments that that all those things that affected him in his childhood, being an orphan, apprentice, a slave, those things repressed his ability to uncover himself. And it's implicitly, the whole premise of the book is that, you know, he has gotten to that phase in his life, and as he reflects back, he tells us his path. But the path is going to be different for every single person. I think that's the underlying message that should be taken from Rousseau's Confessions.
All right. Thank you. We take a moment to crystallize your questions. All right, questions for Sri. Yeah, Karen.
Do you see him as a classic narcissist? Because I do.
That's interesting. So this is what I think. I think that he's enlightened. He thinks he's an enlightened person, which is true, because this process is, ultimately, it should be enlightening, right? It's a journey to yourself, your true self. And I think it leads to a lot of conflicts, but one conflict is that he's narcissistic in the sense that he has this pride, like, look at me, I don't need material possessions, I steal things, but it's not for the same reason as the other thieves, I'm stealing for some other reason that's dignified in its own way. And the conflict is that, you know, he has that pride, but also with his sensibilities, with just how he is as a person, his disposition as a very sensible person, someone who understands everything, talks about how he, all the time he spends running or chasing down animals, hurting other animals because they're bigger or stronger than the others. So it's obvious that he's caring. So it's a conflict between those selves, a selfless self and the pride and almost the power that he gains by becoming and discovering himself. So he is, in a sense, definitely narcissistic. I mean, we see that in the first sentence.
Yeah, you can see. He says, I saw myself as occupying a position infinitely superior to that of the apprentice I had once been, as far from perceiving that as being used to a superior one. So he kind of, in hindsight, you can see his follies, but he also is forgiving of himself as a child, but he's not very forgiving of himself now, and he's certainly not forgiving of. He can be forgiving of other people, but he doesn't tend to be. He tends to be kind of harsh on everybody.
Yeah.
He kind of projects like his evil thoughts onto other people too. I understand what I'm saying. So it seems like he's got a lot of negativism.
Yeah. He's going over his whole life, so I guess yes, the negative and the positive. But I kind of was when you just said that, I thought of Montaigne. The Hamlet poem sonnet that we're just reading, where you know the conflict is obvious in the two different parts. In the first part, he kind of says, "Oh, but even in the roses there are whatever bad things." So I think he's kind of trying to justify that. All the bad things I would have done are forgiven because I've found a self that is, I've discovered myself that is flawless and is perfect and can never, it's almost beyond any, you know, societal notions of being evil.
Yeah,
criminal.
I think he has a harder time forgiving himself than he thinks society will.
Yeah, he definitely battles himself. And I think, I don't know if I'm wrong, Jerry, but he wrote this in fragments. Between 1765 and 1769. But it wasn't published until he died. I don't know if that was on purpose.
Well, the first part was published while he was alive. He actually got to be quite famous by reading.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's...
out loud in a scandalous way. But you're right, the second volume, which is supposed to be published.
And the other thing I saw about it is he seems to be disengaged his entire life. He can look at himself from outside pretty much all the time, even as he's going through it. He's analyzing himself.
No, that's true. Like, I think what he's doing is giving us a premonition of what it is to be at point B. He's like, I'm at point B, and now everything I've done from between point A and B is, it's nothing. It means nothing. I can, obviously he still has a conflict over it because he's always battling whether it was wrong, I should take the beatings for my sins, but at the same time, I didn't mean it in the way that they do. You know, it's like drawing the distinction between being in point B and everyone who's at between. Yeah.
But well, as you said, he has a lot of inconsistencies in his life. Confession is really is in one part a litany of sins, and yet he does show how someone may love themselves. And he offers himself the judgment of to being a strong and very worthy self that has been true to itself. But in light of these sins of inconsistency, what would you say he's seeing as his meaning of himself, the identity of himself that is so noble?
Well, what I see is that he uncovers himself. So it's I drew in a lot from The Origin of Inequality. But basically, if I can go back real quickly, in that work, he specifically states that he deconstructs society down to the caveman. He says that this person, the savage caveman, he is the ideal representation of everything that is virtuous in human life. So he says that by doing the same, you know, going back at his life and all the things that happened, all the influence, by seeing his journey to getting back to that point. And obviously, you can never get back to that point because it's you're living in a different time in natural society with language, so that's not possible. But he's just saying that it's noble because an example of stealing, you know, he says, I steal for a different reason. They steal because they believe that these material possessions are something that they need, that without them they can't be defined as a person. Whereas Rousseau kind of justifies his stealing his other sins by saying that even though I hadn't, at that point, I wasn't my true self, I can forgive myself because now that I'm at this noble point, all of those things were obviously in a different intentionality than everyone else.
I thought that the progression, maybe I was being too simplistic of putting a bucket because you sort of said consider the diachronic versus the synchronic self while we were reading him. And I thought that it wasn't so much, I didn't look at it as forgiving because I thought he was really narcissistic too. But I just thought that it was like that was self one. Now I'm self two. I don't have to forgive myself because that's not me. That was one, now I'm two. And then the next he moves along and then he's three. So it's almost it's like he's compartmentalizing the growth of his self. It gets to the point of reference. So I like your comment about that he's the point. I mean, I think he uses his current self as a point of reference for the previous self. And it's not like he doesn't need to give himself. He doesn't need to forgive himself.
No. I think that's like the conflict.
And I guess between that point sort of a little bit different than giving the forgiveness piece that we've seen.
Well, I think he feels a lot of shame, but he doesn't ever deal with it. He refers back to it a lot. He's not processing it. He's just, like you said, compartmentalizing different parts of himself.
He hasn't resolved it already. Because right. That's in box one. He's moved on to box one, so how can he resolve it? Right?
I think
recounting his transgressions, he seems to do it with an absence of a sentiment of regret, or if there is a sentiment of regret, it's that something happened to him rather than these reports that he when it's called confessions and waiting for him to confess.
No, and that's how it's different than Augustine, because
so I'm curious.
You know, it's almost as if he's just saying, well, that was a completely different person, you know. I can't even fathom what that person was thinking. It's...
And I'm just curious, like, how do you influence, how do you interpret that in terms of his vision of the self? Is he an agent of his own actions, or not?
Well, I think it's kind of like he's assuming that because he's found what he believes is the true noble self, that even at those earlier points when he was doing things that weren't, that he regrets, he feels like this part of himself, this noble self, was there. It was just being repressed, so that he wasn't actually doing them in the state of mind of what you would regularly associate it with. It was like, my true self was there. It was just, it was covered up. But therefore, I can't associate my actions completely with why such actions would be taken otherwise, you know, in society. But I think it has a lot to do with not just, we talk about the inward finding itself, but also his way of deconstructing. You know, he has a critique of education and how the influence of education is disastrous to children and the values that they are subjected to further the process of repressing who they truly are and should be. That's mostly just my opinion, so you guys should chime in. They're so confusing.
A couple of things I'd like to...
The sense I was getting was a lot when you put up that agent versus passive judgment. It was a lot of the sense of him kind of drifting through life, and kind of like as things happened to him, he kind of like adjusted to it, and he just been just kind of like, okay, well, this is happening now, so I'm going to turn this way and I'll turn this way. Whereas if you look at Descartes and the other ones, there seems to be a lot more of a deeper purpose of this is what I want to do, or this is kind of, and even if the feeling is that it's kind of like, I just happened upon the other issues and I just happened to then deal with it in a way, but not really setting out ever to really wanting to do something with this life or finding, well, what is my purpose? That, and I'm not sure if I get for me it was a lot more descriptive as opposed to like an apology about this life or what I've done wrong, which is, that is just what I did. And given the same circumstances, I was doing that. That's kind of how I was directed, or how life directed me.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead. Yeah, Tomash.
I think I agree. I didn't put such a nice word, but I think I found it more descriptive than narcissistic. It was just a journey that was going along. And even his defense of stealing is actually, at that point, it's not that he's saying it was okay to have stolen. It was convenient to have stolen. His argument about money is that the problem with money is that there is a cost in transforming it. He says you can't really enjoy money unless you transform it. And he did enjoy the process of transformation. Which is like if you buy wine, the guy's going to poison you. If you buy an apple, it's going to be green. And that's the sort of example he gives. So I found it very much, in fact, actually one of the easiest reading. And I actually, my question for you is, I really didn't see how it fit into the reading as much as the other books that you've given us so far.
Yeah.
This was a pleasant read, you know.
I didn't want the unifying theme to be unpleasant. Probably
not. Thank goodness.
Yeah, I could have picked worse things. Okay, so a couple of things coming out of this general discussion. We didn't... This is my fault for rambling early on. I want to leave us some more time at the beginning of next week. We're going to start losing track a little bit here, but we haven't had enough time to discuss Rousseau. And we had a good presentation that raised a lot of issues, but I'd like to think a little bit more, and maybe you could sit on it for a week, and I won't just preach at you at the beginning of next week. But there's a couple of things that have come out of this conversation that has happened after Srini's presentation. One is kind of... it'd be nice for us to have a theory of why he's telling us the bad things that he did. he's not just telling us bad things, but I think we are all concerned about what the purpose of telling us his sins are. Whether sins is not the right word, right? But let's just, maybe stealing the ribbon, let's say, as an example. Why does he tell us that? What's the function that is being served by him? Let's just use strong Augustinian language here. Why is he confessing his sins? And we have some opposing views of why this is, right? One is simply that these things happened, and he wants to lay out the facts. It was said about that event that I stole this ribbon, I got blamed for it in this way, but this is what I was feeling, this is what happened to me, right? So description, that's one view. Another is justifying, right? Self-defense. Well, when I stole things, it was convenient. It's not, that theft wasn't bad in a certain way. This is why I did it, right? Self-defense, explaining. It wasn't like you thought. And then there's another view, which is kind of self-exposing or narcissistic, which is there's some kind of impulsion to share, which exceeds the purely descriptive. You need to know what did I masturbate and when, right? You need to know that. If you're going to get me, boy, I got to give you a lot of detail, right? Detail which might surprise us, but let me tell you, in the 1760s, it was pretty shocking for folks. And that was in a period in which erotica was readily found, right? They were familiar with sexual materials. They weren't familiar with this kind of sexual materials. So kind of self-exposure. I was going to make a list here. Descriptive. Justifying. Are there other ways we might see this kind of... We're just listing? Yeah, no?
So he doing this in terms of thinking about claims. So I thought, was he using these as groups of individuality and multiple selves? I mean, so are they groups? Are they shocking groups?
Good. So he claims in the beginning, there's never been anyone like me. Is this simply evidence of that? Right here. Check this out. Yeah, great. Great. That's another good reason. So I think this is a problem we got to figure out. And it's a problem which clearly subtends the whole book. Why did he write a book, and why did he call it The Confessions? Right? He's clearly got a project that doesn't entirely resemble Augustine's, but he chose the same title, and it so happens that he also described early on in the book a very fundamental theft, right, which changed everything. So he's clearly working with Augustine here, right? He's Augustine's in the background here for him. And yet, the way the book starts is not at all how Augustine's book starts, right? Augustine's book starts with praise to God, an impossibly good God, and an impossibly bad individual. The first page of Rousseau is just me, 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 me. Right? Rousseau knows that, right? He's doing that on purpose. Why would he do that? He seems to not just simply be narcissistic, but flaunting. Right? It's become an explicit part of his project to say, there is no one like me. That's a weird thing to do too, right? Why would you share an inimitable example? What's that for? So, we have some questions about kind of motivation. Why is he doing this kind of thing? And then a question that Ramesh, I think, raised here is Rousseau trying to tell us something about the self, or is that actually not really what's going on here?
I think the self is proof not of just his individuality, but of the individuality of the self.
Okay, good. So we might imagine early on, maybe Noel's throwing out a vision of the Rousseauian self, which is just radical individuation. What makes us the self is that we have almost nothing to do with each other, right? That the set of experiences are the people we really are.
Is more like Homer than Rousseau is like Augustine.
Good. Yeah. Great. Great idea. Yeah.
Well, he wants to validate himself, so he makes the sacrament of the confession. This magic confession doesn't work unless you tell everything. You cannot hold anything back.
Right.
And he wants to be our tutor, as he describes his meeting with the tutor, who. impressed him and gave him many of his fundamental ideas, and he says it worked because he came down to his level and admitted some of his weaknesses, and this was found very effective.
Yeah.
He describes that experience, but primarily he is opposite to Augustine, and that where Augustine ran from his feelings, this man says, no, I am my feelings. I am not my judgment. I do not have to judge what is moral. All I need to do is look in with myself and be feelings, because that is what is natural. And if it's natural, it's godly, because that's what his religion, his Protestant religion, tells him to be. And since people are the opposite at this time, they're very judgmental, and they're very much setting up morals, and primarily people are Christian submissive. You know, the virtue is submission, and he is not submitting. He is saying, you know, he is integral with himself. And for some innate reason of his own, he knows he is a real person, that he was true to what he was as a child. And he's literally putting it out here, both because in his old age he's confused that he's not liked and criticized, and because he thinks that he knows or thinks it's of value, because he did so carefully put out his true intuitions and experiences. And it's true to them that he literally needs this.
Good. Okay. One last thought, and then I want to try to wrap up.
So what I observed is that King started writing this, so he has attained at that particular label, whatever that constant self or external self, and then he's presenting whatever has happened before he discovered himself. And that's where I see he can put it in all neutral fashion what has happened, and always he's trying to say, unless and until I discovered myself, there I am, this is what, and that's where it comes from. I don't have to justify, I don't have to submit, because that discovery was incomplete, but now I'm at point here where I'm crystal clear.
Good, great. And, great. Okay, so this point brings us back to another potential parallel with Augustine, right? This is one of those bummer things where I didn't think you read enough Augustine or enough Confessions. But we might imagine that both of these books tell the story of a life seen from some point where there was some kind of transition. Something happened, and person A became person B. And it's person B telling us about life A. Changed, a changed person. This is what I was like before the change. We know Augustine's talking about it, right? He's describing a life of sin from the vantage point of someone who's now converted. So Augustine has explicitly this structure. Book 9 changes everything for Augustine. And the rest of the book is the Christian self. And before that is the lost, sinful self. So in Augustine, that structure is perfectly clear. Is that what's going on here? Is Rousseau talking about his life not just as phases? Well, I can't be held responsible for that because I'm now this, or even that, now I'm this. Right? This kind of, we might imagine several Rousseaus in which there's some kind of responsibility problem or some kind of agency problem. Or is he doing this, where he's achieved some kind of clarity about what the true self is, or about being true to himself? And he's looking back on how that process happened. How did I get there? So we might employ that model for thinking about this book. Okay, so homework. I want to come back to this next week, and I want to let you guys talk a little bit and me talk a little bit less, although I've got my ideas about this too, as you might imagine. I'd love you to try to come up with a theory of what he's up to. Why is he telling us this? And you might try to expand it to why is he telling us everything, or you might try to focus on why does he want to tell us in all these details about things that we might call bad, you know, moral faults. I gave up my children for adoption, and then I went and had some more, a lot more. Why would you tell us that? Right? So, and does that help us understand his project? I think this idea came up a lot, both in our presentation and our discussion afterwards. What does Rousseau mean by being true to himself? What does that mean, to be true to yourself? What is this true self? Is it his feelings? Is it his experiences? Is it this kind of
pure self that isn't responsible for these bad things? What is the self that he's talking about when he is true to himself? So I think we need to meditate on that expression, try to get some sense around it. And then finally, as Noel started to do here, let's try to build a Rousseauian picture of the self. What kind of picture does Rousseau give us of what it is to be a self? Maybe just himself, or maybe a broader picture. Maybe Rousseau's trying to say, even though he makes himself an exception, maybe he means to say, we're all like this. Like what? What are we all like? What's that self that Rousseau's talking about? So those are three things that I think we ought to focus on next time for a few minutes before we move on to Nietzsche. Okay. Yeah, sorry, Rob.
I'd like to mention, I found a little anecdote that the historians say that Mary Shelley was reading Rousseau, and that's when she began her story of Frankenstein.
Yeah, good. And that's not only true of Mary Shelley, but all the Romantic poets. Huge influence on the Romantics.
So, but it's very Kantian, and that Kantian shit really makes a game of just the games Kant was describing with moving the self between bodies and what is the self. And then she shows what happens when the self is innocent and then becomes corrupted in its system, as Rousseau essentially did. So nice. That's her model, I think, with Rousseau.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Robert. Okay, it's 9:06. I promise to only take one more minute of your time. As you approach Nietzsche seems to be writing about all kinds of crazy things. I want your laser-like focus on the following two things. Nietzsche seems to think that we have a picture of the self that doesn't make sense. He's maybe the first figure that we're looking at who has a critique of our idea of the self. He thinks there is such a thing as the modern conception of the self, and that it's flawed. We don't have an accurate picture for complicated reasons. But Nietzsche thinks that we are mistaken about the nature of the self. That we have gotten confused about what the self is. So there's a critique that Nietzsche has. You should try to identify what that critique is. In its place, he is recommending that we think of the self in another way. So it's good to think of Nietzsche not necessarily as describing, but criticizing and endorsing. He thinks we think about it in one way, and that's bad for us. And we should think about it in another way, which would be good for us. So he's not a describer, he's a prescriber. So try to think about Nietzsche along those lines as articulating a critique and then endorsing another view which is different than that critique. Okay, so try to work with that. That might help you focus a little bit as you follow the torturous twists and turns of his thinking. All right, guys, good luck. Good discussion tonight. We'll do a little bit of Rousseau next week before we move on.